Ready?
I'm ready.
Here we go.
Living in a scientific age, we need citizens who know enough about science to make intelligent decisions about what they do. We've used science to prolong life, to increase security and happiness. But it can also be used for destruction. Are we going to use it constructively? It'll be up to you, and you too.
Hey, Todd.
Hey, Mark.
So,
Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hi, Mark.
So the Unipiper walks into a bar. And he goes up to the bartender and says, "Hey, I'd like a fruit punch." And the bartender says, "Hey, sir, you know, if you want punch, you need to get in line." Unipiper looks around, and there was no punchline.
That's actually pretty funny. I like that. Not only is that a joke from whole cloth, it is a joke about the Unipiper who is here in studio with us. Well, welcome, Brian.
Did you use that same joke last week?
I don't know. Did you?
No. So I that's why I asked you about it, because I used it on a Facebook message to the group that you so you've read that before. You just haven't heard it from
apparently so have I, and it didn't stop me from being surprised all over again.
It was in your voice in my head.
So you had heard it.
Yes, welcome to another episode of the Mark and Todd Cast. I am one of your hosts, Todd Workoven, and with me, as always, is Mark Middleton. How are you, Mark?
I'm really well.
And like I said, in studio is Brian Kidd, the Unipiper, fresh from his overseas adventure to Holland and Amsterdam. Is that correct?
I just flew in from Amsterdam, and boy are my arms tired.
Okay, well, you're not going to take Mark's job of of terrible jokes. We already have too much of that. So tell us about this trip.
It was crazy. I was in Amsterdam for about 48 hours, and I had just 2 days to perform at a gig and then also do a little sightseeing and touristy things as well, and take in as much as I could. It was a very interesting experience. The gig that I did was part of a celebration for the TV show Vias de Mol, or The Mole, which is one of the biggest reality TV series in Holland and Europe.
And they used to have a version here in America with Anderson Cooper as the host,
right,
before
yeah.
he was on CNN.
Oh, yeah.
It
I
didn't really
that.
Take off in America, uh-uh. though. But it's still going. It's on season 17, going on 18.
Oh, my gosh.
And so each season, they film it in a different location. And this season,
how
the past season.
I love Holland. How many different locations are there in Holland?
Well,
or is it all of Europe?
It's like around the world.
Oh,
it's,
kinda, okay.
it's like Survivor okay. style.
Further down the street, I guess.
So they've been doing it for 17 years, and
they
had not done it once in America yet. But this past season was all in Portland.
Okay.
And it was, I've watched a couple of the episodes that are on YouTube with English subtitles, and it's really neat because it's like presenting Portland and Oregon as like this idyllic, quintessential American place, and how America is represented to Europeans.
Wow, that's so. All the people on the show are from a different country.
No,
or
they're
are
all from Holland, and they're okay. all somewhat of celebrities within Holland.
Okay,
they're stars on other shows.
So it's like The Bachelor always has like the they were from season whatever, and
yeah,
okay.
And okay. so they compete in this show, and like Survivor, one person gets voted out each week, and one of them is the mole, and they're trying to kind of sabotage the game for everyone else. But anyways, it just wrapped up, and each year after the show, they do a celebration of the season. They call it like the fan day, and people come out and get to meet the cast and crew. And then since this one was set in Portland, Travel Portland had a booth set up there. To try and talk to people and encourage them to come visit Portland, because that's what the season was. It was like one long commercial for
right.
Tourism in Portland. The Unipiper was there along with a couple other Portland performance artist to try and bring a little bit of Portland's flair, bring the weird, if you will. And it was interesting to see their reaction to the Unipiper. They were definitely keeping their distance. They were unsure what to make of me, kind of like when you give a new toy to a cat and they don't quite know what to do with it. It was crazy, though. They had this stage where the event was taking place. It was taking place at the television studio where the production of the show takes place. And everywhere in Holland, just driving around, there's like lakes and moats and just water bodies everywhere. So they had a giant water body at the TV studio, and they set up pontoons in their little lake. And then on the pontoons, they built a stage in the middle of this lake.
Oh, wow.
And then they covered it in kind of like a moon bounce inflatable topping. And then within there, they hung a giant, we're talking like maybe 40-foot American flag.
Oh, my gosh.
And they at one point had the Unipiper. I walked out onto this floating stage and then had to do a performance and not fall off into the water. Above this giant American flag.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
It was crazy.
So was this all done live, or did you do a couple
It wasn't broadcast. It was an event just for people to attend meet these people, and they did a Q&A, and then I hand out Keep Portland Weird stickers and talk to folks about how awesome Portland was. But it was really funny because they built up Portland. They wanted Portland to be everything about America to the viewership of the show.
Wow.
So they really wanted to portray it as like the Wild West.
Right.
So in the show, they did things like ride horses, and at this event, they had bales of hay set up to kind of make it seem like the Old West. And there was a BB gun activity where you could shoot balloons with BB guns.
Wow.
They had some food carts there.
And this wasn't Oregon. It was Portland specific.
So the show, they filmed it throughout Oregon with a strong emphasis in Portland.
Okay, well, then that makes a little more sense than if it was, had a couple other Oregon locations.
It was all strictly in Oregon, like, the show.
But when you think of America, you know, the United States, you know, you saw the video clip of the float that was in that Italian parade, and and Trump notwithstanding, you know, there were so many iconic, you know, the Las Vegas sign, and just when you are remote outside of the United States, what is it that comes to mind when you think of Holland and or the United States, or, you know,
right,
India or something, like the iconic images. I can imagine that, you know, the Wild West and cowboys is such an iconic measure of the United States.
They had a food cart there. It was American Street Food was the subtitle, and it was the name of the food cart was Queen of New York. And then their menu was a chalkboard, and it said burger 5, drink 2.
Nice.
Yep. I guess they got it all.
They nailed it.
Yeah.
Burger, drink.
And my other favorite part was this lady who came, and she just kind of looked off in her wardrobe. I couldn't tell what was going on. She was wearing this really floofy white shirt, long sleeve shirt, and then she was wearing a brown leather corset over top of this shirt. Then she had normal jeans and then like these really steampunkish boots with gears and stuff. And she came up to me excited. She wanted a photo with me, and she was like, I dressed like Portland. And she's like, I hope it looks right.
Oh my God.
Yes.
And is amazing.
I've got a picture of her. I'll show it
to you later. Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Wow.
So
that is so funny.
It was weird for them to see probably the Unipiper, and it was equally as weird for me to be in this like alternate American reality universe.
It's like off-brand America.
Yeah.
So did they, like, is the Unipiper a known entity?
No, the Unipiper was not in the show, they probably should have had the Unipiper in the show.
I was going to say, like, just in the opening or something like that.
But there were some people who knew of the Unipiper. I got some questions about whether the Unipiper was one person or many people.
Nice.
So now all the people I talk to, they're going to expect me to be here when they come and visit.
Well, of course, of course, on every street corner.
Yeah.
That is really cool. And so, yeah, you pretty much just turned around and came right back home.
Yeah. But while I was there, you know, I wanted to see and soak in and experience as much of Amsterdam and culture and food and stuff as I could.
Yeah.
So I did a little bit of shopping.
Nice.
And I've got a bag of treats here, and I thought maybe we could do a brief taste test.
That's sweet. Nice.
Let's start. I did buy Todd one specific thing. I saw this in a store, and it really spoke Todd to me, so I'll give that to you.
All right. We have it in a nice Capital City of Holland bag.
So,
oh, it's a pen, but it's also what do you call it?
So if you push this button at the top and then aim it at the table, it is a mini ViewMaster, and it projects images of Amsterdam.
Oh, that's hilarious!
Oh, so yeah, you hold it pretty far away here. It's kind of too light in here, but. So I'm projecting it on the. I'll hand it over to you, Mark.
Several different images.
Hold it about maybe like a foot away from the dark side of the dark side of the table. So yeah, it almost looked like a thing that you look into people's ears with.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, it projects. It's like a ViewMaster. You stick it in your eye. It's like yesterday when I stared at the sun to see if it really did hurt.
So I did bring back some Stroopwafels.
Cool. Nice. Oh, they're tiny little packages.
They're individually wrapped.
Look at that.
Those are just the regular kind, so nothing too interesting there. Yeah. But right here, I have the harder to find cheese variety.
A cheese Stroopwafel?
Yes. So let's.
I'm agog. Well, yeah. First, I'm looking at the.
I guess I can't
show my shut my computer.
Mark,
the little individually wrapped ones, because usually they're the size of a teacup, more like that.
Right.
And so yeah, these ones are a little bite size. Okay, we're gonna eat.
Oh, they're they're kind of like cheese crackers.
Crisp wafers.
Interesting.
And they smell pretty cheesy.
Oh, they're delightfully crispy.
Mm.
So they are shaped in the waffle shape and size of a Stroopwafel.
Very good mouthfeel.
Kind of like Dutch Gouda cheese wafers.
Kind of in the Cheez It category of cheese flavors.
A flavor profile and a Pringles texture. We're practicing for the PDX Fast Foodie podcast that Nate Heath is starting. So I'll just mention Nate Heath and Dave Baylor, who goes to my church. I saw him this morning. And he's like, I think it's like been 4 weeks in a row that you've said my name on the air. So there's that this week's saying.
Those are legit good.
Yeah. Those crackers are good.
I just love seeing the junk food in other countries. It's like an alternate universe.
Totally.
Because we don't have this stuff. Okay, so here's two flavors of Mentos. Fresh cola and chocolate and caramel.
It is. Yes. Holland is the land of Mentos. Caramel and white chocolate. And fresh cola. That'll be interesting.
Break into those if you want. But I'm most intrigued about this. Ice cream flavored Oreos.
Oh wow!
They're just ice cream. Like not
purple.
Any.
And they're purple.
And they're purple. So is it grape ice cream or?
So this is biscuit sandwich. This is in. I was gonna say this.
It's in Dutch.
Not in English. This is in Dutch. Except just all the flavors with blueberry ice cream flavor.
Oh, it does say blueberry.
So, oh yeah, chocolate sandwich cookies with blueberry ice. Cream flavor.
So what's the difference between blueberry flavor and blueberry ice cream flavor?
I don't know. Should we taste this?
Yeah, we should taste this.
This is the exciting part of the podcast, the visual part of the podcast, and the textual where you get to eat it.
The next segment is podcast magic, our magic show.
Close-up magic on a podcast. Is this your card? All right, mine's broken a little bit. Better.
Oreos are getting crazy in America right now. I don't know if you've seen. They have like Peeps flavored Oreos.
I saw the Peeps ones. Well... Oh, that is gross that we're all chewing into the microphone, but...
I don't know if I get ice cream, though.
I don't either. Cut this out in post.
It's kind of spicier. It's minty.
It's not... There is a mint aftertaste.
That's... Why?
Maybe it's blueberry toothpaste is kind of what it tastes like. Or berry-flavored toothpaste. So speaking, I'm only doing this because we're in the Oreo segment right now, because I had this for later and I would have brought you one, but I didn't know you were coming. So I brought for Mark, it is an Oreo egg and it is the shape of a Cadbury egg, but it is Oreo and it is a cream filled candy with cookie pieces.
What?
Now I saw these at Safeway yesterday. I'm going to hand it over to you. I saw those at Safeway, and I was like, oh, my buddy Colin would love those. And I was like, well, if I get Colin one, then I have to get Liam one. I have to get Liam one, then I get the other three. So I bought those, and I'm like, I'll buy one for Mark and bring those as a reveal. But if I bought... So I bought one for myself, and then I shame ate it in the Safeway parking lot later. And it is a lot. I thought maybe it'd be a cookie, not a cookie, but the consistency of, I don't know. Like I thought it'd be like the
cookie
brittle
shell.
I thought there'd be the chocolate shell. And then I thought the inside would be more crisp somehow or like, but it is just full on
Oreo cream
with cookies crumbled up in the middle.
The packaging looks like an egg shaped Saturn. It's got an egg and then it's got this ring around it. That's a cardboard.
And so you peel thing. That open. So that peels in two and then the plastic shell comes off. So it's not like a Cadbury egg. It's a plastic little shell that opens up.
Gosh, I really feel like I just brushed my teeth.
I know. Well, you guys should both
partake.
It took me like 10 minutes for my body to process that I ate that.
So the mold is clearly an Easter egg, but it's not necessarily Easter branding.
No.
Huh.
But yeah, it's clearly meant to be. I don't know. I don't know if the same company makes Cadbury eggs or not. Yeah, it is.
It is a lot.
It is a lot.
Whoa.
So as you guys, I guess, and that's why I kind of wanted to wait until we had a longer.
Because the inside isn't.
News story.
It isn't like the consistency of the Oreo cream that you would expect, like more dry. This is very creamy, like the inside of a
Cadbury egg. Yeah. And I think that's what got me. I thought it was going to be more of a cookie-ish texture, but it is just full on lard.
Well, while we're talking about cookies and junk food,
we are going to beat PDX Fast Foodie at its own game.
Kit Kat that is filled with cookie dough.
Oh my
chunky
gosh.
Kit Kat.
What?
Oh, can we try that?
Go for it.
Are we going to try all these? Chunky cookie dough Kit Kat. My gosh, what a time to be alive. It is always weird looking at the stuff in different countries.
Although now it's for less amount of time as the diabetes takes over.
What a time to give myself adult onset diabetes.
Oh, you're working on that. I'm going to open the next one.
Oh my gosh.
I'm mostly curious for those that can't see. This is a package of Haribo candy. I've never seen one that is called bananas, and they look like giant bananas.
And it looks like the gummy bears packaging.
I was mostly just curious whether it tastes like banana or if it's just banana shape.
Oh my gosh, this Kit Kat is to die for.
Oh my god. Just smell this bag.
The Haribo banana.
Jared says, what is this? PDX?
Fast foodie?
Fast foodie.
Do they taste like circus peanuts, these Haribo bananas?
They're gross.
You don't say. I'm shocked. It's harder than it is kind of marshmallowy.
It tastes like an unripe banana, which I despise unripe bananas.
That aftertaste gets you. I was going to say it tastes a lot like circus peanuts in the taste and consistency, but all of a sudden 4 seconds into the bite, this aggressive banana flavor comes
out. But
not
just banana. I love banana runts, like that artificial banana. Yeah. That's fine. This is...
It is, because it does have a sourness to it.
Ugh.
It's like a lime. Did you try
Mark?
One of these?
No,
I'm not a banana fan. My buddy Colin, I'm going to have to take a picture of this. He's going to be so mad I ate all this candy without him. He was watching this great YouTube video, just 15 minutes of like just giant mounds of candy and two hands like opening it up and then eating it like Cookie Monster. And that video had like 15 million views.
Welcome to the...
It was amazing. Why did I eat the other half of this banana thing? That was
because
I was just holding it.
Oh my gosh. Here, wash it down with some Kit Kat.
I know, I'm still eating ice.
Look at this. Will you just look at this table right now?
We are disgusting.
I'll take a picture of it.
I'm not going to be able to sleep with myself tonight.
Oh, my gosh.
I do like the Cola Mentos, by the way. They're really good.
Are they?
Yeah.
Did you try the Choco Caramel and White Chocolate? That's going to be kind of weird to have a chocolatey...
I wonder if those would also do the Mentos soda trick, or if they have a different outside texture.
I wonder if the fresh cola would do the Mentos Cola trick.
It sucks the foam back in.
I did not care for the blueberry Oreos.
No, the banana was my least favorite, but oh, really? the Oreo is a close second because I do not want to feel like I just brushed my teeth after eating an Oreo.
I'm going to save that Mento there because that's going to take me forever to eat. Well, yeah, it is always fascinating seeing I guess there's two things, the approximation of American things from a foreign point of view, like when you go to their grocery stores, but then they little have the little American snack section and they have all that stuff. But then there's also the stuff that they just have with their stuff that's strange to us. I remember going to Tanzania and in one of the grocery stores, they had, I was looking at all the potato chip flavors and like, there was, I guess the weirdest one, and it isn't terribly weird, it was just tomato flavored potato chips. And I was just like, buy the normal everything else. And just like you said, that everything that's just slightly off a little bit.
Yeah.
But
I remember in Italian grocery stores, we spent a lot of time looking for what we know as an Italian blend of seasoning, right?
What do you call that?
What do you call that? You know, and
just blend
it. Yeah, it's farm herbs, basically, like okay. Country spices, okay. You know, country herbs, and
the last example I'll leave you with from the Netherlands. I saw a McDonald's advertisement for a sandwich that they were calling the New York Bagel Supreme. And I have no idea if this was supposed to be a breakfast item or a regular menu item, but it was, sure enough, an everything bagel, but then it was like 2 quarter pounders and just regular cheeseburger in the middle. The yes. New York Bagel Supreme.
That is awesome.
Yeah. And their advertisements as well. There were these giant posters while I was waiting to get on the metro, and one of them was that bagel. But all of the poster boxes had an NFC logo, and it said interact with this ad, so you could hold your phone up to the ad to learn more about it.
Oh, interesting.
And I thought that was a cool use of technology.
Oh, so like it was an electronic, not a visual, like a QR code, but a
right.
I'm holding my phone close to it.
Yes.
To get a signal.
There was a QR code as well, but the other option was to just tap your phone to learn more.
Nobody's ever used a QR code, right?
No. Do you have to have a special app for it?
It
like depends. A reader, I guess?
Yeah. I do on my
most
iPhone.
Phones, I think, have it built in.
But like, I was going to say, like, if I just took a picture of one with my regular camera on my phone, I would have to, like, I couldn't. It wouldn't do anything. It would just take a picture of that.
Likely
right?
not.
Right. Right. There was a problem with the Google Glass originally because it would process QR codes and do things with them. So people were hacking the Google Glass by showing image, like presenting code that would maliciously attack.
Or just have it be a so dirty crazy. QR code. I am ashamed to admit there was a period of time that the Unipiper used to ride around with a QR code on his back.
Nice.
If any of my viewers currently ever scanned that, could you please drop me a comment? I'd love to know.
Did it just go to your page or something?
Yeah.
That's funny. All right, before we dive into some news here, and you're gonna stay the whole show, and you're gonna read some news with us, and
aww.
You're gonna talk about our topic with us.
Thanks,
I was
guys.
Talking with Colin's older brothers, the teenage boys, about I've been thinking just a lot about sound lately, and I can't think about it too much because it when you think about headphones and how they're pushing air and that make you can it sounds exactly like what it's supposed to sound like, it just boggles my mind. Like I can't wrap my head around it.
Right.
But I was thinking about the slogan for Alien, which is in space, nobody can hear you scream. And I was wondering if that's totally, like, when does sound, like, when my body produces sound, I am taking air into my lungs and then I'm pushing that air out and it's vibrating in my larynx, blah, blah, blah. At what point does that become not sound? Like, if conceivably there was a way to set that up in space or whatever, and you're just standing next to the whatever, like, can they hear the sound that is resonating in your skull yes. and around?
So sound is transmitted by atoms and molecules brushing against each other and vibrating each other and passing that vibration on. And so you can hear me when we're talking in the same room because of air and right. the amount of air that's in the room. And
that freaks me out too. Just tiny little differential in air pressure. And that's what,
that's all know. It is. And this so is if we took the, if we took the air out, your sound, you could still expel, like assuming that you had superhuman strength and could
something in your lungs
exist in a vacuum without exploding or having your blood boil, your sound would go across your vocal cords and vibrate them, and then ultimately those molecules of air coming out of your mouth would
disperse
and not brush up against anything because they're in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, the sound stops right. transmitting because there's nothing for it to vibrate up against.
So if you screamed into someone's ear, could they hear you?
If you were able to transmit, transmit those, if there's enough molecules between you and the ear, then yes. But if there's a vacuum between you and the ear, they cannot.
So weird.
Yeah.
Huh. Anyway, that's what I was wondering about this week. But I did get an email this week from Tesla. Did you get an email from Tesla this week?
I'm refresh. Really behind on my emails.
because they were announcing that their Model S 60 and Model S 60D have been discontinued. And I didn't know if that was the one that you pre-ordered.
No. Okay. It's a 60 and 60D are the two.
Yeah.
So, it's my understanding that those are being discontinued because of the retooling of those production lines for the Model 3.
Right. Okay.
And so the Model 3 is what I ordered. So those are the Model S 60 and Model S 60D.
Okay.
That have been discontinued.
All right. Interesting.
So those were the lowest end of the Model S line.
Okay. So yeah, I wondered. I couldn't remember which. They will be missed. Well, and they're still making the Model S. It's just that was a different battery capacity that wasn't...
Exactly.
People weren't ordering as much anyway, so...
They'll soon be showing up at the used car lots on 82nd.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. and I did have a note to talk about April the Giraffe, too, but I guess there's still no news on the... Have you guys been following the saga of April the Giraffe?
It's like watching paint dry or something.
And now everyone...
So... Is it the same giraffe that has I've received 18 alerts over the last year and a half that log on now and see this giraffe drop.
Yeah.
It's the same one.
It's the same
one. It's been weeks.
I feel like at least a month
months,
at this point.
Right? A little month, and a month and a half maybe? Yeah,
which is funny because everybody is getting so invested and angry and like at this stupid poor giraffe that's not having its baby.
I'm sure we've talked about it before, my affinity for giraffes. Because, like, I'm a giraffe nerd and I went on the Let's Go Feed the Giraffes down at the safari outside of Roseburg.
Yeah.
And I happened to be the only person, me and Nick were the only people on the entire tour. Normally they have like 25 people.
Right.
And so it was me and Nick and this poor... lady that works there as she's a giraffe tender, and she just had to listen to and confirm all of the things that I'd gathered as points of data about giraffes over the years. And I finally had a giraffe expert in front of me.
Nice.
And so I was validating every fact that I had put together. So,
right.
Is it true that giraffes are afraid of heights? And she's like, yes, we can put a 10-inch curb around their enclosure and they just won't step down over.
Oh, my gosh, that's
like
fascinating.
That. And that they make no vocalization. That is true, although they have been heard to hum in their sleep. There's no other audible noise that they make.
Because I heard for the longest time that giraffes have no vocal cords, although I feel like a couple years ago they were like, that's not entirely true.
It's not entirely
true. They
just
don't make a lot of sound.
Exactly.
They just I was really bummed because I had been saying that forever. That's probably in my fascinating facts book is probably why I kept repeating that.
Totally.
Instead of watching the giraffes, we should have a camera set up on all octopus enclosures just to catch one of them escaping, because that would be the thing to
that
see.
That would be cool. That's have you heard about Inky the Octopus?
No.
I meant to just read that story again this week. I put a little GIF in the link in the in the shared document there, which is my my favorite giraffe gif of all time.
Melissa Workla says hi.
Isn't that horrifying? I think I've seen it.
It's like terrible time
to you before. It's just a giraffe licking a chain link fence pole, but it's disgusting. Anyway, yeah, those are all the notes that I kind of had to talk about. So April the giraffe still hasn't given.
Still pregnant.
I did see a pretty hilarious headline that was April the giraffe in hot water after fake pregnancy scare to keep boyfriend or something like that, which is pretty funny.
Was that officially The Onion? Or
it wasn't The Onion. No, yeah. It was other than The Onion.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Cool. You want some...
Is there anything that you're going to read in the...
No, yeah. So I was doing some 3D printing reading recently. So there's...
Are you in the market?
I not for the types of 3D printing stuff. I am in the market for a 3D printer at some point, but it's lower on my priority list right now. But there's two things that have been released recently. One is for those multi-filament 3D printers, the ones that have kind of the same concept as multicolor printers, is they can expel whichever filament for that point in the design that they need. They've got a new filament that is water soluble, so that they can create designs that are fully supported physically during the entire printing process. And then once it's entirely printed, they put it in water, and anything that was printed with that supportive water-soluble filament just dissolves away. And so currently there's a lot of limitations on 3D printing for anything that overhangs, because as the printing process happens, if you have like the letter T... that letter, the top part of the letter T, doesn't have anything to support it during that printing process.
Right.
And so they've got a new filament to change that, basically. And so it would create an entire rectangle with supporting areas for that part that's under that overhang of the T. And so they can get really, really complex shapes that they weren't able to get before, because of this water-soluble filament.
Wow, interesting.
And then before we recorded, I showed you the video. I haven't shown you the video yet, but there's a Russian house 3D printer. They've been experimenting around the world with 3D printing of houses and structures, and most of them have been either basically a brick printer that just spits out bricks, and then they use those bricks to build the house, or they will 3D print a section and then mobilize that section into a house. And this one was a new style of printing, and basically it was a cylinder in the middle with a big arm, and that big arm 3D printed the entire building around it. And it wasn't a massive building. It was kind of a pod house. So like a single, almost like a studio apartment. But they started and completed in less than 24 hours in the entire structure, including all of the embellishments. So they, like, today you had a blank piece of land, and tomorrow there's a house there.
That would be amazing for emergency response.
Emergency response. Homeless programs, low-income housing initially. Wow. And then I want to add an ADU onto my yard. You know, I want a really nice shed or a garage or a workshop out and back. They bring in the unit, they plop it there, and then tomorrow it's there. And it's fully unique, custom cement design. It's not, and it's all... contiguous. It's not just bricks and mortar. It's
one solid
structure.
Wow,
it's really cool.
And soon you'll be able to order an entire house through IKEA. Then
exactly, and you'll order it in your VR, so that you can see it in front of you.
You just eventually you take your VR off and then
it's still there. It's there, yeah. So IKEA has a VR app that they are experimenting with of, I want to see what my kitchen looks like.
Oh, right.
And with the Vive especially, you can walk around and see that space and literally take your controller and open cabinets and see what it looks like in your kitchen. And it's just...
That's crazy.
Does the Vive support augmented reality?
Not yet. Yeah. Nope. So the Microsoft...
Is that where you can walk around and catch Pokemon?
Yes.
right. I mean, that's everyone's... Yeah. That's the famous example of augmented reality, right?
Exactly. Okay. So in that case... And augmented reality is I'm seeing the environment that I'm in with an overlay of whatever the 3D item is. And so the Microsoft VR that they're working.
HoloLens.
The HoloLens, which I don't think is publicly available yet, but it's in pre-release. That is basically a fancy set of sunglasses that overlay 3D interaction into your environment. So I can be modeling a new car that shows up on my table next to me.
Man, what a confusing time.
Awesome.
What a confusing time to be alive.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's get into some of our news here. Did you want to take some of these stories, Brian?
Yeah. Do we want to start with maybe a couple Portland items?
Yes.
Events. So on my way out of the country to Amsterdam, I got a chance to stop by the new Hollywood Theater Micro Cinema, they're calling it.
Oh, yeah.
At the Portland Airport.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw your picture.
It's really neat. They've taken like the Hollywood famous marquee from the outside of their building, mm-hmm. and it's now in the theater.
So is it an I don't understand how this is an airport. Like, what is it?
So
you can go see movies there or what?
You can see short films. Short they films. Have okay. An exclusive lineup of films that I assume they're going to change out monthly or every few months or whatever. Okay. So they had a program, I think, of a dozen 2 to 10 minute films. And you walk inside and there's maybe, 15 to 20 chairs, like actual movie theater style chairs.
Oh, wow.
It's not very big. It doesn't need to be. And I just walked in there, sat down, and I didn't have very long. I just kind of watched one.
Where is it in the airport?
Shoot. I think it's Terminal C.
Oh, so it's past security?
It's past security. Yeah, unfortunately. Okay. But that leads, thank you for that segue, Mark. the Hollywood Theater on Friday, the real Hollywood Theater, they're going to be showing that exclusive program here. So anyone that doesn't plan on going on a trip anytime soon and wants to check out these films that they've created especially for the opening of that theater, they're going to have a chance to do that this Friday at the Hollywood. And then you can hang around because after that they're going to be showing Soylent Green that same night.
Yes.
This Friday.
Nice.
Yep.
Well, that's cool.
And then if you wait, fast forward almost a week, Thursday, March 30th, mark your calendars. It's going to be the release of the third Unipiper beer.
Wow.
At Rogue's Eastside Distilling and Brewery. Formerly known as the Green Dragon.
Right.
Anyways, I will be there on March 30th and we will be releasing the Uniporter.
Awesome.
Yes.
That's awesome.
So the previous two, there was a Unipiper IPA.
Yeah, the Unipiper IPA.
Unipiper.
Pickled.
Yep. And the Pickled Piper.
And the Pickled Piper, yep.
Which was distinctly pickles.
Was it as pickly as the banana treats that we just ate?
Yes, but less disgusting.
Yeah, no.
In fact, it was not actually any disgusting. Yeah. It was good beer.
Yeah, nice. it was good beer.
But it did, yeah.
Very pickly.
You could tell.
It wasn't like a hint, a note of cucumber in the background. No, this was like pickles. And if you didn't like pickles, I love pickles.
Right.
So it was great for me. But you like were either a fan or not a fan.
It's like how the scratch and sniff pickle ones are very distinctly dill.
Yes.
Those smelling. Also in the news, Portland, I feel like this is becoming a trend, but this week we're reporting the loss of the 30-year-old head shop on Hawthorne, the Third Eye.
Yes.
I love this place.
It is.
Makes me sad.
Yeah. If you don't know the name, just look it up on Google Maps. You will recognize it. It's the really funky. They've got the whole front is painted with like.
It was like an old house looking thing. Not a storefront.
Yep. And they had kind of a wacky space themed painting right on the front of the building. And wow, it's been there for 30 years. And, you know, I'm just looking at the image now and imagining like a condo in its place. And it makes me really sad. Like, this is a legit example of the type of character that we are actively losing day by day.
And known for.
And they, Third Eye is obviously, they've been there for 30 years. And the people are always great. And, you know, the most memorable moment that I had at Third Eye was on September 11th, 2001. My best friend at the time and I, the other best friend I had, Mike, who was a mutual friend, we had a really significant day. We had I taught school in the morning and then we had a big presentation at work for this big thing and everybody was just so overwhelmed and so heavy and so everything. And so Mike and I went to Third Eye and got a couple new pipes and we just, we got stoned. And it was the only response we could come up with.
The coping mechanism. Yeah.
And so thanks Third Eye for being there.
I actually bought my niece an eighth grade graduation present there because just paraphernalia they had.
Yeah, there's the head shop upstairs and there's a really interesting
arts and crafts. Yeah, but they had these really cool handmade wooden boxes that were kind of puzzle boxes that had a magnetic. So there's the main box that had a locking mechanism in it that was run by magnets, and they gave you like a checker sized magnetic wooden piece that would go on top of it, and if you knew where to slide that, then the mechanism would open and you can get into your box. It's like a little jewelry box. And so I got one of those for my niece's eighth grade graduation because it was so cool and all that. Yeah, all those little handmade wooden things that you see. But another casualty. So
In a similar vein, I have a news story here about an art project that's happening in California throughout the Coachella Valley. Artists are replacing or purchasing space on highway billboards and putting up images of what the billboard is blocking. So if you were just driving by and you'd see mountains in the background, but there would be mountains on the billboard.
Yeah.
It's very clever and very neat.
And I liked it because until they put a picture of what you're not seeing on the billboard, nobody would have noticed that.
Or thought about looking
at the view. And I love that story just because it's just such a great, it's just a great little art moment of making that statement and point and just
art that anyone can understand and appreciate.
Yeah. It just makes me sad that Clear Channel profits from it. You know?
Totally.
But now I'm thinking, I know of several buildings in town that I would just love to see painted like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And one day we'll have all LED buildings that can just mirror what's the nature behind it. So it's like looking through the city.
Invisible cloaking buildings.
Cloaking buildings.
Patent.
You heard it here first on the Mark and Talkcast.
So Goodyear let out the air out of its last true blimp in Carson, California. Goodyear has always had their blimps. I'm not reading from the article specifically, but I grew up in Southern California as you spent a lot of time in growing up years. Uh-huh. And as a child, we'd always go, not always, but many times we would go to Carson to watch the launch and landing of the Goodyear blimps. And so I grew up around that.
We saw them all the time, but I'd never gone out to see them inflated.
And that is right by the freeway. I don't remember which freeway it is, but
the California.
Exactly.
Take 205
to the 216 and then go over the expressway and then you're right there. And so I remember from a having that connection, talking to one of the pilots that was, had questions and stuff.
So did you get to see the little basket or whatever?
Yeah.
Up close? How big is it?
It's
like the size of this room, except thinner.
Exactly. It's about this long, and I think it seats six, maybe.
Wow.
There's a really interesting video when, back to Google Glass, Google Glass, when they did their launch party, they launched, there was a event going on in the Moscone Center in San Francisco, and they launched from the blimp skydivers with Google Glass on, and so you could watch their experience skydiving, and then they handed off something to the thing and did the thing, and then they ended up in Moscone Center.
Wow.
But yeah, it seats like six, maybe eight, and
it's gotta be loud, right?
Yeah, there's turbofans right next to you.
I guess I didn't realize until this story that they're phasing the old ones out, you know, and building ones that have actual structure to
ribs to it. Yeah.
And I guess I never thought about that when they would park the blimp and take out the helium or whatever. It would just go all the way flat. Like how do you store that or fold that? Like a fitted sheet.
Very carefully. Yes.
Speaking of blimps, have either of you guys ever been out to the Tillamook Air Museum?
Yes.
I've been out by it. I have not been in, and I absolutely want to go in.
It's really cool. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's just huge, but my favorite story about that, because you're driving down these country roads or whatever, because it's out kind of in the middle of nowhere,
yeah,
and it is the biggest building you've ever seen in your life, and painted on top of that in the biggest letters you've ever seen in your life, it just says Air Museum. And I mean, those letters have to be 12 stories high, yeah, or however big they are, so you can see it forever. And we are driving down there on a family vacation. I was with my family and my niece. We rounded the corner or whatever, and you just see Air Museum, and she looked at it and she goes, "A museum for air?" it was so funny. What is this, a museum for air?
It needs to be at least three times this size.
If you're not familiar with the Tillamook Air Museum, it is one of what was originally 17 buildings constructed by the U.S. Navy in World War II to construct blimps that were being used in the war effort. And they were designed large enough so you could have the entire inflated blimp enclosed.
Inside.
Yeah, and I think maybe all but this one have since either been demolished or burned down. So this is the last one.
And it's a massive wooden structure, too.
Yes, it's so large that it has its own weather systems that can develop with inside the building. There can be clouds inside the building.
That's crazy. Yeah, it is huge in there. I mean, that goes without saying, but when you're standing in the middle of it, you're like, ugh.
I mean, it's definitely just as much of an attraction to see the building itself as it is to see the airplanes in there.
Yeah. Yeah, and they do have a couple airplanes in there, and they have a little whatever that you could stop by, but yeah, it's a cool place. And
there's a classic photo that shows an airplane flying through
the building.
The building. It's a, you know, two-seater airplane, but it's, you know.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
What did I want to do? Oh, so there was a new U.S. ruling from the House of Representatives that acknowledged that Alexander Graham Bell did not invent the telephone. Now, historians and Italian-Americans won their battle to persuade Washington to recognize a little-known mechanical genius. So there's a guy named Antonio Meucci, and he is now considered the father of modern communications 113 years after his death. So his, what he called a teletrofono, I don't know. Mark, how would you say that in Italian?
I'm looking for where it's spelled. Where,
it's like two paragraphs.
Teletrofono.
I would say, they'd say it with their hand somehow, I'm sure.
Teletrofono.
Okay. So yeah, let's see, where did I just lost my place. So in the 1930s, this guy had moved to Cuba and he was working on...
1830s.
What did I say? 1930s?
Yeah.
Oh, 1830s, yeah. So his wife eventually became ill and became paralyzed, and he rigged a system to link her bedroom with his neighboring workshop, and in 1860 held a public demonstration in the press. In between giving shelter to political exiles, Meucci struggled to find financial background, blah, 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 and failed to master English, as did I, and was severely burned in an accident. So he... He couldn't afford, eventually could not afford the $250 he needed to make a definitive patent. And so he filed a 1-year renewable notice. But then the next year, 3 years later, when it came up, he could not afford the $10 to renew the patent. He sent a model and technical details to the Western Union Telegraph Company, but failed to win a meeting with the executives. When he asked for his stuff to be returned, he was told they had been lost. 2 years later, Bell, who shared a laboratory with Meucci, filed a patent for a telephone and became a celebrity with a lucrative deal with, yes, Western Union. So now he has been reinstated as, or not reinstated, I guess, instated for the first time as the person who invented the, and just another story of how all those inventors that you always hear about, all the politics that went on even back then with getting patents out and taking credit and stealing ideas and all of that. So,
Cheerios gives away a billion.
Is this your favorite story ever based on that look you gave me?
I love Cheerios. I love Cheerios.
We don't have any of those on the table.
We don't. So they started with a goal of giving away 100 seeds, and they're flower seeds that are used to attract and
100 million seeds.
Yeah, 100 million.
Okay. You said 100.
Oh, 100 for not, every man, woman, and child in the country.
Not as impressive.
Just
still
100
nice.
Seeds.
Just enough.
Just 100 million seeds. And they're seeds for flowers that will help bees and expand mm-hmm. their life and all that. They've given away more than 10 times as much. So they've given away 1.5 billion seeds. So currently they've stopped the giveaway, but you can find out more information at Cheerios.com.
Because of the story that they stopped?
Because they gave away all their seeds. They ran out of seeds.
They ran out.
Well, and there's been, I didn't post the link to this, but there's been some controversy.
Well, that's what I thought you were going with.
Yeah, so there's been some controversy.
I didn't see the word controversy.
I didn't post it in here, which is why you didn't see it. I don't know who wrote it, some botanist or something like that, warning that because these seeds weren't region or area specific, you're like basically just throwing invasive species where they don't belong.
I forgot who it was, but it's like a very legit organization that said, whoa, this is not a good idea. And the funny thing was, the group that they purchased the seeds from, they do sell regional packs, but they just bought the cheap variety mix that they could just distribute to everyone.
And that article also complained about like honeybees, like we have enough honeybees to like last. It's a big business, but it's the other bees we need to worry about. And it's not just the whatever. So I thought it was funny that there was
the thought that counts, Todd.
I know.
This is the anti-article.
Exactly.
That's right. You're reading it straight from the Cheerios page.
I know. I've only seen one side of the story.
Well, I'd flagged that earlier in the week, and then I saw that follow up, and it made me laugh. So,
Todd, I do want to have my question answered. I know there's one story in here that I read the title, and I don't know the outcome. And
yes.
It was up to the state court.
Yes. So there is a state. This is my favorite story in a while. A court's decision in a Maine labor dispute. hinged on the absence of an Oxford comma. So if you don't know what an Oxford comma is, it's when you have a list of three or more things, like I'm going on a picnic and I'm bringing a blanket, chairs, and food. And it's putting a comma at the end, right before where the and goes, where the conjunction goes. It's putting a comma before the and, which there's always a huge nerdy debate about whether or not to include the Oxford comma.
I'm bored
some
already.
Some people don't want them. People like me who know better know that you always, always, always go with the Oxford comma. What is your...
Thank you. Okay. I'm always in favor of the Oxford comma. There's never any ambiguity that way.
Exactly. And we'll see here all of the Oxford comma deniers get what's coming to them in this story. So a Maine court ruling on a case about overtime pay came down to grammar. So there was these delivery drivers that were trying to win overtime through their company. The company was saying, well, you guys don't qualify for it because of this and that. So they went to court and they looked at the all of the paperwork that they signed, all their job duties and stuff like that. And it came down to the serial comma, also known as the Oxford comma, is in the very first sentence of this story, but you won't find it here. So they leave the Oxford comma out of this long list, of their job duties, say canning, processing, preserving, freezing, drying, marketing, storing, packing for shipment or distribution. And so they did not put packing for shipment, comma, or distribution. It just says packing for shipment or distribution, making it one thing.
One item, yeah.
And so in the comma-less space between the word shipment and or is where it all came down to, because if that was two different things, then they needed to be paid for it.
So they had more duties.
So they had more duties for it. So if the lawmakers would have used a serial comma, it would have been clear that the distribution was an overtime exempt activity on its own. But without the comma, the law is ambiguous as to whether distribution is a separate activity or whether it was on its own.
Nice.
So, yes, the courts rule in favor of the Oxford comma. Mark, are you still with us?
No.
Do you like some caffeine?
Nope.
I can go on about the Oxford comma for days.
Next, I want to see the court's take on GIF versus GIF.
That one I can throw my hat in.
There's also the other. Here's a. I don't have a pro tip bell like the Not Nerd podcast, but if you ever want to be seem extra smart and snooty, there's a because in grammar in English, none of the rules follow. Like there's always exemptions and stuff like that. So it's hard to keep track of where a lot of things go and what needs to happen. But always, 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 if you have a period or comma, they always go inside a quotation mark. So whether or not the whole sentence is in quotes or if it's just the last word of the sentence that's in quotes, a period and comma always go inside the quotation marks, even though it kind of looks funny. Unless you're in England, which they don't do it that way, but periods and commas always inside the quotation marks. That's your grammar tip of the week, which should be a new segment here.
No.
I'll start my own podcast just about right. The Oxford comma.
Well, it'd be like, you know, let's have a MySQL, you know, a configuration tip of the week.
One of my favorite books I've ever read is called Eat Shoots and Leaves which is a fantastic book about grammar and punctuation. Do look it up. Yes. Yeah, so moving on, there is some sad news as one of the original artists of the Garbage Pail Kids has passed away at the age of 72. His name was Jay Lynch. And over the few decades at Bazooka Comics, he went to the Garbage Pail Kids, which began as a satire of Cabbage Patch Kids. And of course, just went crazy in the 80s. They were banned in schoolyards. I was like, parents hated him and schools hated him, but all the kids wanted to have him. And it was kind of the trading card equivalent of Mad Magazine, how it was like kind of dangerous to have. And like the kids thought you were going to, I never
they
really
were
had any.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were very edgy. Lots of vomit and people being, you know, Cabbage Gore. Patch Kids looking. Yeah. I never knew what the Todd one was. Like did you guys ever know what your own name was or your own Garbage Pail Kid name?
No, never, never owned a Garbage Pail Kid.
No. Well, all right.
I was not into them, but I'm surprised I wasn't into them.
Yeah. Cause it was prime. In the late 80s, I think that it was around a lot. There is, it's traveling around right now, so I couldn't find it anywhere, but there is a documentary called 30 Years of Garbage, the Garbage Pail Kids story. So that's traveling around if it ever comes to your town. Let me make sure. Close that. So today, actually, this topic is from one of the teenage brothers of my buddy Colin, who when I asked him, I'm like, what would you guys listen to something about? And they wanted to know about the real life town that the game Silent Hill is based on, because they're big video game players, and the game Silent Hill is a horror thriller game. I don't know. I'm not too much of a gamer to know how to describe it.
Psychological horror.
Okay, and you arrive at this town that is literally just burning. It's like a burning heap of a town that's been closed down. Do you know that?
Yeah. So you're talking to a Silent Hill nerd over here.
Oh, okay.
So I can tell you probably more than most of our listeners care. But in the original game, it was only fog and mist. This is constantly kind of shrouded.
Okay.
And it wasn't until they made the Silent Hill movie, when they changed the origin of the atmospheric fog to it was actually smoke.
Okay.
And so in the movie, the town of Silent Hill is where all the games take place, and it just messes with people's mind in there. It's always surrounded and covered in this fog. So, and then when in one of the reboots of the game, they took that plot line from the movie, and then now some of the games are based off that movie plot line of that it's the town was burning and then it was evacuated and it's just always been burning.
Okay.
And that's where it's actually smoke from the fires.
Okay, yeah. So this it's interesting that the evolution of that story came in an intertwining between the games and the movie. That's kind of funny.
But yeah.
It is kind of based on a real life place, which is called Centralia, Pennsylvania. And Centralia is a little what they call borough. So it's kind of an unincorporated place, kind of in the middle. Like if you're looking at Pennsylvania and it's kind of a rectangle-y shape, I guess it's kind of in the middle and then toward the eastern side of Pennsylvania. And it's been a mining company since the 1850s. So in 1856, some mines started moving into the area. The Locust Mine and the Coleridge Mine opened in the next 8 years. Three more companies had moved in. By 1866, the town had incorporated, and their primary and only source of income was anthracite coal. And so it was a town that was run by not necessarily nefarious types, but it was kind of a mob-like attitude because it was the coal industry was in there. So you had a couple, you know, of the rich owners and stuff like that. So there was lots of arson and lots of murders. And there was a Roman Catholic priest who lived in the town that in retaliation for being assaulted, he cursed the land in the late 1860s. But at the late, in about 1890, had the maximum population that it ever did, and that was at 2,700 people, 2,761 people lived there in 1890, and that was kind of the just ramping up to peak coal in that area. So in the next 20 or so years, coal would peak in 1927 and then start declining, and then we have the stock market crash. And then all of the mining companies closed and moved out of town. There was a couple left, but it was mostly bootlegger miners. And they would go into the existing mines of these companies. And because those mines, all the shafts were held up by pillars going all the way through, all of those pillars were just part of the mountain. They would just carve around, you know. And so they would take the coal out of the pillars.
Oh, wow.
Which, of course, would make the mines collapse. And so there was a lot of these interconnected and now collapsed tunnel system surrounding and underneath this whole town. So by 1950, the township bought all the rights to the coal underneath it. They were still banking on a big turnaround. But in 1962 is kind of when our story kicks more into gear. So at one of the old abandoned strip mine sites, they put the town landfill, and every couple of years they needed to, quote, clean the landfill, and said they would just kind of burn the burnable stuff, you know, and make room and stuff like that. So five firefighters were hired to clean up this area, and they started a fire, and they had done this before a couple times in the town, but they had moved it now. And since they had moved the landfill, they didn't put the clay fire resistant lining underneath where they just dumped everything.
So they were trying to burn the trash at the landfill?
Yeah. Yeah. So they'd come in and set, you know, back then, I mean, it was the 1950s and 1960s. So there wasn't a whole lot of, please don't burn. Don't just open air burn garbage. So, but unfortunately, and there is a little bit of controversy. So most people say that the firefighters intentionally, you know, set the fire as they had done before in a controlled burn. Some people say that there was a trash truck that came that had some burning coal still in it, like from somebody's, I don't know why they would take burning coal that way, but it was dumped out. Regardless, it was not fully ever put out. And nobody really noticed for a long time. And so that was in 1962 is when they eventually realized that this, because that landfill wasn't fully put out, the fire followed a vein of coal leading it to all of those underground tunnels. And now we have that whole underground system of tunnels, 400 acres of underground tunnels and coal just burning. And at this point, we can tell because there is just smoke coming out of the ground. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But initially, they didn't really know what was going on until 1979 was one of the first times they've noticed, because there was a gas station owner there that was checking the tanks that he was holding the gas in to see if they were full or empty or whatever. And he pulled out his dipstick, and his dipstick was 172 degrees. And so they had just been putting this like boiling hot fuel into people's car for years until they kind of noticed that.
So did mining completely stop at some point in those years?
It dwindled, but as late as the 1950s, the township was still claiming the coal rights. So there, most of the big companies had moved out, and like I said, there was some of the bootleg mining. There was,
I'm wondering if anyone tried mining and realized things were on fire and they couldn't do that.
Yeah, it didn't say. So I'm guessing at this point, and the whole town itself is one quarter square mile. So it's a very big, it's just kind of the blip on the map, the area. So it's 153 acres is this little township. So, I mean, people work other places and other mines of other interests, and lots of the stuff under their town had been abandoned forever anyway. I mean, who thinks twice about all that until it's on fire? So that was in 79 where the gas clerk noticed that it was 172 degrees. In 1981.
Talk about a slow burn.
I don't have a. Oh, well. I took my. This is a sidebar for those that can't see it. The wonderful.
He's getting better at that.
He's getting better at that. My slide whistle that Brian had given me. I had it in my bag, and it fits perfectly in my bag. And I wanted to keep it nice. You know, I was worried about taking it out, but I've needed it three times this last week, and I haven't had it, so it's going back in my bag. So I'm just gonna put it in there. I've needed it. I needed that slide whistle. Someone fell down, and I was like, "Oh no, I don't have a slide whistle." That would have been amazing. Anyway, getting back to Centralia. So in 1981, there's a 12-year-old named Todd Domboski, and he was playing in the backyard. Another Todd.
Todd.
He fell into a sinkhole that was 150 feet deep. He got swallowed up by this mud pit / sinkhole that he, thankfully, the person he was with his cousin, and his cousin just blindly grabbed at the hood of his jacket that was going down and pulled him out. And even though he was in this big winter coat, you know, and pants, he was burned because the mud was so hot and it started coming out. So still after that, the residents of this place.
And what's the population again?
I was looking here for the population. I think.
You say it was like 2,700 to start with?
It was 2,700 to start with, and that was in 1890. So I think we're down to 1,000 at this point. In the 70s and 80s, it was around 1,000, give or take. And they were still arguing about whether or not it was dangerous to live here. This was as Todd got swallowed by the earth. They're still debating. That was in 1981, and so these two different factions of people who wanted to leave versus the people who wanted to stay. It was like a Hatfield-McCoy things of like, you aren't loyal to our city, and you just want to move away. And then the people who had been there for generation, like five or six generations, wanting to stay. In 1984, Congress allocated $42 million for relocation for all of the people that were living in Centralia.
Wow.
And most of the residents took that buyout. And I had the numbers here for that buyout, but now I can't find it. Oh, that comes later. There's a different buyout later. So they had the 40 hello.
Sorry. End time.
That was my, and we're done. Find out next week what happens to Centralia. In 1992, they finally claimed eminent domain on the entire area. The Pennsylvania government did that, and they condemned all of the buildings and all of the property. The residents that were still there tried to overturn that. In 2002, they changed the zip code so that they first were just going to take away the post office, but the people complained. And so they changed the zip code, which effectively did the same thing, but in a different way. That was in 2002. In 2009, there was a formal eviction of all of the remaining residents.
So in the interim, were they having accidents and...
They were and they weren't.
It's like, oh, there goes a car. That's there's a part of life.
Yeah, there's a great documentary that was done by PBS, I think, but it's on YouTube, and it's just called Centralia. And it's about, it's more about the people who lived there than it is about the story as a whole. But it's really interesting to hear the perspectives of the people, because initially when the government came in and said, we'll invoke eminent domain, but you will never, you can live here for the rest of your life. And like, that was just a flat out lie. And so a lot of the residents were like, well, screw it, we're just going to stay here. And so even though the government owns everything, all the buildings in there, there are still people living there that were, I mean, basically squatters, even though it had been their house for generations and all that. Technically it was owned by the government. And so in 2005, there were five houses that remained on about seven people that lived there. Most of them like old timers. There's one old mayor and, but going back to the 70s and 80s when the kid got swallowed by the earth, they put vent pipes into the ground to channel the heat and the smoke that had. I mean, if you're picturing like a road that's kind of buckled a little bit, like an old country road that's kind of burbled up in the middle from a root or whatever, imagine that. But there is sulfur and steam and burning coal coming out of those holes, and there's cemetery, there's like four big cemeteries that are in this little town too, and like there's smoke and steam coming out of the cemetery, and they have chimneys that just like dot the sidewalks that are about 4 foot high that look like I have a little wire trash can basket around it, but that's to keep people away, and that's just where all this gas and all of the smoke is venting. Yikes. Out of the ground. So by 2012, seven of the people that kept living there, that still lived there, filed for a reversal, saying that most of the fire has spread now somewhere else. I mean, because they are pretty tiny, and the fire was 400 acres, and it's been burning, you know, for decades. Who knows how long? And so they've tested the air quality, they've said, and the remaining residents, and so they were petitioning to stay. But in 2013. The residents settled for $218,000 for their homes. They settled. So they got $218,000 for their home and the right to stay in those homes forever. And then they got an extra $131,000 for something or other. So they ended up, the people that still live there are still allowed to live there in their own home.
How many people do you say? Like six?
In 2012, seven people filed for the reversal, but there's only five houses that remain there. So I would say maybe nine or so people.
I'm looking at it on Google Earth View.
There's amazing pictures if you just Google Centralia, Pennsylvania. And there's a lot of cool YouTube videos that just show the town.
So can you still drive into the town?
No. You can drive around the town because it was just, you know, in the middle of the highway on the way to two better places. You know, one of those towns where it's like, you know, just a couple of buildings. Like I said, it was small. But because the road was literally consumed in fire that was coming out of it, they finally had to shut it down because like nobody could see the path. So they put two huge piles of dirt on each end and they made a path that just goes all the way around the city, and the city is surrounded by the warning signs that say underground fire, unstable ground, carbon dioxide, sulfur. All of it is coming through cracks at the bottom. And the kicker is that this fire, which is still burning, is predicted to continue for another 250 years because there's no way to put it out. They've tried to like flood it with water. They've tried to put fire retardant down in a hole or what. But there's just, I mean, it's like an anthill of connected things.
Connected to the rest of the country.
Yeah, just veins out. Yeah. So an interesting place, and it kind of is emblematic, I think, of a time in America where there are these little industry towns that like once that core thing goes away, the town is decimated and there's nothing for it to do. And one of the quotes that I liked from the documentary that was on YouTube that I was watching was talking about how we all know how towns and cities start. We can see that and visualize that, and that's happened before, but it's hard for us to know and understand how a city or town ends. Like, it just sort of trickles out. Like in a gold boom type town, you know, that's maybe a town for 2 years or whatever, and that makes sense. People move in and out, things are meant to be temporary, and the saloons come down or whatever. But in towns that have industries like this that are, you know, from the last century, like coal, when you take that away, there's nothing. Yeah, you can't move the people that have been there for generations. Like, what do you do with these? How does a small town die or not die or stay not dead? So there's a lot of little towns like that, whether it's like automotive industry or agriculture. That's no agriculture, I say with an odd inflection. Agriculture. Culture. Oh, that's good. I had my thing. Okay. Culture.
I barely knew her.
All right. So yeah, it's worth looking at least with some pictures and there's some cool drone footage and stuff like that of Centralia, Pennsylvania. But an interesting story of a town that's just has been built on fire for the last 50 years, which is crazy.
It's insane.
So pretty much it was begging to be made into a horror.
Into a horror movie. Yeah. Yeah. That's why it kind of surprised me. It was in the movie before it was in the game. So that's our little story for today.
I love it.
Anything else, Brian? What can people do if they want to find out more about you?
They can always look me up on the Facebooks at The Unipiper and check out my website at unipiper.com. We should probably tell the rest of the story from last week because it was so funny. You had set me up. I laughed.
Yes, I did.
I had not laughed that long in a very long time.
Did you go back and listen to it?
Yes. It's so funny.
So yeah, I have started selling my notebooks on your Unipiper page in the little shop there.
Right. Oh, on Facebook, and you had thrown me a low ball to you're like, so
I heard you got some interesting new products in that shop of yours, Brian.
Yeah,
to which you should.
Just, I completely forgot, and when you listen to it, it sounds like, if you know that that's what Todd was setting me up for, it sounds like I'm just being a jerk and just like, that's right, get all your Unipiper needs.
And you know, what was best is you said shower curtains.
Yeah, shower curtains.
And that was it, and I was waiting for it to, and you're like, don't laugh, it's not funny, there's really shower curtains there.
And you're like, is that it? Yep, that's it.
That's all you can get.
So yeah, that was pretty,
so
that
this
made
week
me.
Check out the Unipiper's Facebook shop where you can get Todd's awesome custom pop culture VHS and comic book notebooks. They really are cool, and
are.
I've actually had a couple of people ask me if you take custom requests.
Ooh, I do.
And of course Todd does. He has the inside scoop on where to pick up a vintage VHS in Portland.
So. Yes, I have a good source, so it's likely, although not promised, that I could find what you're looking for. But yeah, you can check that out at A Real Piece of Work or facebook.com/A Real Piece of Work, and that's WERK, like my last name. But yeah, that does it for another episode of the Mark and Toddcast. Join us every week as we talk about science and culture or whatever it is we feel like discussing. You can find out more about us at facebook.com/ The Mark and Todd, or just Mark and Todd, I guess. Whatever.
Facebook.com/Mark and Todd.
I like ran out of steam about five sentences ago, and now I'm just like, I'm listing toward that.
Brian is the one with no sleep right
know,
now,
right?
You have no excuses. I have no excuses. It's time for a nap.
It is time for a nap. Oh, and this past Friday, our newest episode of Portland at the Movies came out. So you can find that at portlandatthemovies.com. Episode number 5, Breaking In with Burt Reynolds.
Did you have something to play us out with yet, Todd?
I didn't. Did you find something? I Googled something for, you know, I can play, but
there's a song called Oxford Comma.
Oh, okay. I just searched giraffe song.
It's a good song.
Okay.
Oh, that there's also a giraffe song too.
So yes, I'm looking at the giraffe song. Oh, by Vampire Weekend. I have heard this song.
Yeah.
So yeah, check us out, facebook.com/PortlandTheMovies2 and Mark and Toddcast and Unipiper and all of that good stuff. We're going to take you a little bit of the Vampire Weekend with Oxford Comma. We will see you guys next time.